In no particular order, $1 trillion. All praise the American consumer. And oh, by the way, the past 5 days in this economy, too. All that coming up on the program this afternoon from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, the 13th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It was kind of a grab bag week, actually. A little bit of this, a little bit of that, economy-wise. 6 minutes of live radio to figure out what it all means. Matt Keynes writes for The Economist. Dion Rabone is at Axios. Hey, everybody.
Hey, what's going on, Kai?
You know, it's Friday, man. I'm talking to you guys. That's what's going on. Samia, let me start with you. And while I understand that it can be folly to try to predict what's going to happen with this White House and trade policy, it does seem that there has started to be some easing in the trade war. There are various things being exempted. Nicer things are being said. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm at this point cautiously optimistic that we're going to get something in the next few months. And as you say, folly, you know, it could all blow up in the next, you know, I'm sure it'll blow up as we're...
It could happen right now.
So, you know, barring some angry tweets, at the moment, you know, from what I'm hearing, there are efforts on both sides to essentially try to bank some of the areas of an agreement that there was, you know, they were closer to agreement back in spring before the talks collapsed. So I think there could be some kind of interim deal. I'd be very, very skeptical that there was an agreement that basically persuaded the Americans that actually China was America's best friend. I don't think those deep divisions will be healed, but I think we're going to get something.
Dion, what do you think?
I don't think we're going to get something.
Seriously?
I think what we've gotten so far, this 2-week pushback, buying more agricultural products, we're essentially back where we were in April almost. Like we're actually not even quite there. And on the 15th of October, if Trump's in the right mood, he could just actually go ahead with the tariff increases and put $300 billion worth of goods. So, like you said, it's a bit of a fool's errand to try to predict what's going to come out of this White House. And I don't think, again, even what's been discussed so far doesn't change the trajectory of the economy. We've already seen the impact that these tariffs have had.
Yeah. All right. So to that trajectory question, Samia, I'm just going to read you. It's right here on my computer screen. It's from Reuters, and it says, IMF official, that is the International Monetary Fund, an official there says trade tensions weighing on global growth, but baseline forecast is far from predicting recession. There has been recession talk in the air, as you know, for a goodly number of weeks and months now. Are we all maybe making too much of that?
It's possible. I think this summer people got very, very pessimistic and perhaps a bit too alarmist. Perhaps the word recession was bandied about a bit too much. I think, you know, there are various ways that, let's just focus on the trade war. There are various ways that could play out, right? You could think that we're about to crash into a recession and everyone starts holding back on spending because they're terrified. Or perhaps more likely, you could think that it's more of a slow squeeze, right? There are these weights on the economy. Perhaps it's not quite as frothy as it once was when we had all the fiscal stimulus, that sort of thing. And so perhaps there's going to be a slightly softer landing than people were worried about. And so we shouldn't be quite so worried about sort of catastrophe. Everything's about to plunge into a recession.
Okay, well, so that's reassuring, and that's good that there won't necessarily be a catastrophe. Let me, though, Dion Rabone, turn your attention, please, to the bond market. And there's something that I need your help with, okay?
All right.
So a week and a half ago, after the report came out about American manufacturing, where they said, and we said, we reported it was contracting, right? And manufacturing, certainly parts of it are in a recession. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note, the interest rate that note pays, was down at like 1.43 or something, right? Today, it hit 1.887, I think. That is to say, not a huge gain, but percentage-wise, that's a huge jump, right? What is going on that bond market investors, which we are always told they know what's coming in the economy, what's going on there?
Oh, man. First off, you're talking about 1.88. I got to check my portfolio because that's a pretty serious sell-off in the Treasury market.
Well, right.
I mean, look, here's the thing, and I think we're – getting the cart before the horse a little bit. But as you did mention, the bond market is the smart market, and it's the market to watch if you want to know what's going on in the economy. The one thing I will point out is, first of all, in all this exuberance, the three-month treasury bill is still yielding more than the 10-year treasury bill or 10-year treasury note. Right. That's significant, which means the yield curve is still inverted. It has been for, I think, 2 months now, going on a full quarter. That's still something to keep in mind. But we have seen a pretty significant pushback. I think a lot of people are factoring that into good news. I would say maybe it's more about inflation. We did see CPI, which is a measure of inflation that came out yesterday. It's the highest it's been, I think, since October 2008. It's been consistently the core part of it. Let me make sure and say the core part, which factors out volatile food and energy readings. That's been up above 2% basically all year. And that's something the Fed has been kind of not worrying about, saying that PCE, which is the other measure of inflation, the one that they watch more closely, that's been below 2%. But maybe inflation is starting to pick its head or to rear its head again. And maybe that's what's got bond investors spooked and selling off their bonds. I think that maybe more than good news could be what's at play here.
Okay. A very quick turn now, Smay Keynes, to the American consumer. We're going to have a little piece on the consumer later in the broadcast. But once again, we are being told this week in various indicators that the American consumer is basically the thing that's keeping the entire global economy afloat. And I asked this last week, and I want to ask you, how much longer can that keep going?
I mean, that's the ultimate foolhardy forecast.
I started with a foolhardy forecast. I'm going to end with a foolhardy forecast for you.
They can keep on going for a little while. You know, there was some recent revisions to the savings rate that suggested that perhaps there was a bit more to go. You know, the underlying that positive, that confidence in that spending is a healthy labor market, right? People have money to spend because there are jobs and wages are still kind of okay. Not as good as we'd like, but they're still okay, right? While the labor market is doing well, then people can spend, right?
Yeah.
That's the short answer. So look at the labor market.
All right. Okay.
To find out.
All right. Super quick on the way out. One word answer from each of you. Are you economically hopeful? Dionne Rabone, go.
Always.
Samia Keynes.
Sure.
One word speaks volumes. Samia Keynes at The Economist, Dionne Rabone at Axios. Oh, man. Have a good weekend, you two.
Hey, thanks a lot, Kai.
On Wall Street this Friday, a split decision on the major indices. Not a whole lot of passion, though. Either way, up or down, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so once again, and as Dionne and Samia and I were saying, American consumers, thank you, thank you, thank you. Forget the tariffs and the trade war and global weakness. American consumers are in it. More solid indicators of that this morning. Retail sales up 0.4% in August, way more than experts had been guessing, and hot on the heels of a strong July to boot. And the consumer sentiment survey that the University of Michigan puts out has bounced back from a couple of down months. And yet, we keep getting reports that business investment is down and confidence among business owners and CEOs is down as well. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains why those two paths diverge in an economy.
At this point, it appears consumers and businesses are on different pages. Consumers are in the mood to spend. Business leaders, not so much.
To some extent, they're living in different worlds.
Brad McMillan at Commonwealth Financial says businesses are worried about the global economy and the risk of recession.
They have to hire people. The labor market is quite tight. They have to buy supplies. That's been complicated by the trade war. So they're getting hit on a bunch of different fronts.
He says consumers haven't seen much impact from the tariffs so far. What matters most to them?
Am I working? Do I have a good job? And am I getting a raise? So as far as the consumer is concerned, everything is good.
But in the business world, growth in capital spending has fallen by half this year, says Sam Stovall at CFRA Research. He says many CEOs are well aware.
This is the longest economic expansion in history, or at least since 1857, and sooner or later it will end up slowing.
Or ending. Six in 10 business decision makers think a recession will hit in the next 18 months, according to a new survey from Grant Thornton. And analyst Chris Stevenson says,
there's a pause right now, a pause to plan for potential recession.
Consumer attitudes aren't anywhere near as pessimistic, says Richard Curtin, who runs the Consumer Sentiment Survey at the University of Michigan.
They're not at their record peaks anymore, but they're still very positive.
Curtin says with the job market strong and wages rising, consumers, whose spending makes up two-thirds of GDP, are brushing off warning signs of a coming recession. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Here's another entry on the list of how much longer can mall-based retail hang on anyway stories. There are reports today that Forever 21 is going to close more than 100 stores as part of a bankruptcy filing. The aforementioned troubles that have befallen malls is partly to blame, of course, declining foot traffic. But therein lies the catch-22, because when a once reliable mall staple like Forever 21 closes, there is even less traffic. And meanwhile, the classic mall anchors like JCPenney, Sears, and Macy's are closing as well. So what are shopping malls doing to get people in the door these days? Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
Landover Mall.
The traditional mall, like the one in this commercial from the 70s, often featured four anchor department stores that brought traffic to the rest of the mall.
I love it. I love it. The Hecht Company, Woody's, Garfinkel's, and Sears opened.
But with many of those department stores either gone or barely hanging on, mall operators have had to get creative. Stephanie Sigelski with the International Council of Shopping Centers says sometimes that means dividing up the huge spaces left behind.
There's a mall in Short Hills, New Jersey that did that. It was a former Saks Fifth Avenue that now has Crate and Barrel on the top floor and Indigo Bookstore on the bottom.
In other malls, movie theaters, restaurants, even a go-kart track have become the anchors, and some are turning to non-retail tenants. Tama Shore publishes the Directory of Major Malls.
Anywhere from library space to schools, municipal offices, senior centers.
Steve Johnson with the design and planning firm Gresham Smith helped the Vanderbilt University Medical Center move into a struggling mall in Nashville, Tennessee.
And yes, it has been very successful. 10 years later, it is fully occupied and it is a very well-used clinic now for the community.
And he says the remaining retailers are doing pretty well, too. Consultant Jeff Green helps dying malls recruit new businesses like residential developments and hotels.
So though their life cycle as a mall may be challenged, the real estate that they're on is very valuable.
It doesn't work for every mall, though, and with hundreds of retail stores closing, he expects more malls will, too. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This segment of the program is brought to you by the letter T, which stands for trillions, which is an amount in dollars that you now have to use to describe the federal budget deficit. The Treasury Department said this week that for the first 11 months of this fiscal year, that is from 1 October 2018 to 30 September 2019, the government spent $1 trillion more than it took in. The last time the country saw this much annual red ink was 2012, when the financial crisis and Great Recession were much bigger in the rearview mirror, a time when ginormous deficits made some sense. Now, not quite as much sense, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports from Washington.
If you look at a chart of the federal budget deficit over the past decade, it starts up over $1 trillion in 2009, dips way down in 2015, and comes back up, shaped like a U, as in uh-oh. Because most economists say that in an expanding economy like the one we have now, the deficit is going the wrong way. Harvard budget scholar Linda Bilmes.
What we should be doing at a time when the economy is doing reasonably well is to be paying down our debts and reducing the deficits.
People and companies making good money should be paying lots in taxes. But they're not, she says, because of the Trump tax cuts 2 years ago. Now, in 2012, a $1 trillion deficit made more sense, argues Zach Moeller at the Third Way think tank. We were clawing out of the Great Recession, and government spending naturally rose.
You have more people that are able to go on to food assistance and other anti-poverty programs.
Plus a massive stimulus package.
And then, you know, on the tax side, if people make less money, they pay less in taxes.
That would likely happen again whenever the next recession hits, hiking the deficit further north of a trillion. Can it go up forever? Depends.
A lot of economics is psychology.
Economist Joe Minarek at the Conference Board's Committee on Economic Development says hitting $1 trillion is an important milestone that will test Wall Street's reaction.
If the financial markets begin to think there's a risk to the federal government being able to manage its debt, bond and stock markets can be adversely affected.
As in higher borrowing rates, slumping stocks, and an economic slowdown. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The cottage was a mess. It hadn't been lived in for years.
You know what else it was, though? It was the key to an early retirement, that's what. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 37 points this Friday, 0.1%, 27,219. The NASDAQ down 17 points, about 0.2%, 81.76. S&P 500 lost 2 points, flat percentage-wise, 3,007 on that index. For the 5 days gone by, the week that was, take your pick, however you want to describe it. The Dow up 1.5%. The NASDAQ up 0.9%. The S&P 500 also climbed 0.9%. PG&E, the power company based in San Francisco, reached an $11 billion agreement to settle claims from California's wildfires in 2017 and 18. The company's stock banked 10%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note. Dion's going to want to check his portfolio again. It was actually 1.90% on the yield on the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace. The news moves so fast these days, you might have some headline whiplash, and maybe you need a place to catch your breath or just tune into something that is not on your radar.
And that is what Make Me Smart is all about. We are breaking down big and sometimes small topics into great conversations.
Kai, I don't think you're going to have a quantum computer sitting on your desktop anytime soon.
Well, then I'm out.
Yeah, it's just weird that people we don't hear more about Saskatchewan history.
They hear socialism, they think communist, they think Cold War, they think whatever.
Make Me Smart. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. California Assembly Bill 5, AB5 is the shorthand, isn't even the law out here yet. It's the bill the legislature passed earlier this week that would oblige rideshare companies like Lyft and Uber to classify drivers as employees, not independent contractors. We told you about it a couple of days ago. Anyway, it's not even the law yet, but lawsuits have already been filed. In the meantime, though, drivers are still trying to make a living in the gig economy. Lyft changed its rules not too long ago to get more money to drivers in congested areas, but not everybody loves that. From KQED, Sonia Hudson has more.
Around 4 years ago, Lyft started paying drivers a bonus to go to areas where there was a lot of demand for rides, but not enough cars, like North Oakland during rush hour. And under that system, drivers would get a fare multiplier, say 1.4 times what they would normally earn on that ride.
You would, for those hours, as difficult as they were, that you would make a decent hourly rate for those.
That's Lauren Swigger. She's been driving part-time for Lyft for the past 5 years. We're sitting in her car in Oakland where she lives and likes to drive. Swigger says under the old system, she could make around $200 a week driving 2 hours during rush hour every day, or about $20 an hour. Then Lyft came up with a new payment system for areas where there's high demand for drivers and called it personal power zones.
Now I think I would be lucky to make $100.
Swigger is part of a group called Gig Workers Rising, which says it works with more than 900 drivers in California and is opposed to the switch.
We actually jokingly call them personal poverty zones.
The new system uses flat rate bonuses, say a $4 bonus regardless of the length of the ride. Under the old system, Swigger could sometimes make a $12 bonus on a $30 ride. And now?
Sometimes it maxes out at $4. So $4 instead of $12 is obviously a ridiculous incentive.
Uber uses a combination of flat rate bonuses like personal power zones and percentages like the old Lyft system. Lyft wouldn't make anybody available for an on-the-record interview, but the company maintains while bonuses are smaller, more drivers are getting them. Lyft says that personal power zones were designed to be more predictable, stable, and equitable. And stable for riders, too, when it comes to pricing. Lyft points out the change hasn't driven up fares. And that's true for rider Jared Ledoux, a music composer who uses both Lyft and Uber in Oakland during rush hour.
I haven't noticed a big difference.
In fact, Ledoux only learned about the change in Lyft's driver bonuses when I mentioned it to him. He says he's concerned about drivers, but that the new information is probably not going to deter him from using Uber or Lyft.
I would use it more to get from BART back to my house, so I probably would still use one of them because I don't want to do the walk.
Lyft says, on average, driver earnings across the country have increased over the last 2 years, but it doesn't release raw earnings data. Tom White is an analyst who follows Lyft for the financial services company D.A. Davidson. He says that the change
generally resulted in drivers seeing their payouts reduced.
How does he figure that? Lyft takes a percentage of all fares. And White says that the company's been taking about 8% more from those fares over the last 2 years.
You know, the main contributor to that increase is that drivers are earning less than they used to.
Lyft argues the addition of bike and scooter services accounts for the increase. It takes 100% of the fees on those since there's no driver to pay. But White says bikes and scooters are only a small share of Lyft's overall business, not enough to account for that 8% increase. White says the reality is Lyft is trying to make a profit. Lyft lost more than $900 million last year.
You know, investors won't be patient forever.
The company went public this year, and White says Lyft is keen to demonstrate to shareholders it does have a plan to become profitable eventually. The question for drivers is whether working for Lyft is still profitable enough for them. I'm Sonia Hudson for Marketplace.
We started a new series a couple of weeks ago that we're calling Adventures in Housing, because really, that's what finding an affordable place to live has turned into. According to Pew Research, more of us are finding those affordable places to live on the rental market, not buying, which means opportunity for people willing and able to become landlords. So this next installment of Adventures in Housing comes to us from Davis, California.
My name is Beverly Wilcox, and I am semi-retired. I still do some teaching, but I'm also a small-time landlord. I became a landlord out of economic necessity. In 1990, I had just gotten divorced. I was worried about my ability to afford a house by myself. And so I bought a bungalow, a 1930s bungalow that had a backyard cottage. And the cottage was a mess. It hadn't been lived in for years. But I put in a kitchen, cleaned it up, painted it, and did the floor. And I've been landlording ever since. You know, we're in an affordable housing crisis. And I try and buy and manage properties that will be affordable. Currently, I'm living in a condo, sort of upscale place where nothing needs fixing, and I'm starting to hanker for another project. So I've bought a modular house in a seniors-only mobile home park, so I can continue my do-it-yourselfing stuff with upgrading cabinets and floors and stuff like that. Real estate's gotten completely unaffordable here in Davis, so it may be that mobile homes are going to be where I take my affordable housing business next. Rental income gave me a life I could never have dreamed of. When I rented out that first cottage, it was simply because I was afraid I couldn't afford a mortgage. But as the years have gone by and rents have gone up and my houses have increased in value, it's become something that I can depend on, especially now that I have several properties. If one goes vacant, I will have rental from the other two. So what that meant was
at age 54, I was able to retire from my career job. And I used that opportunity to go to grad school. I have a PhD now, and now I'm in a second career that I really love. So it has meant a totally different life to me to have rental income.
Beverly Wilcox in Davis, California. Help us out. Would you send us your stories of your adventures in housing? You can do that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, MoviePass is going out of business. In other news, MoviePass was still in business. We have told you many times about the movie subscription service's problems. The original deal was you pay a monthly fee. You can see as many movies as you want, even though the company had to pay theater chains every time you walked in the door most of the time. So raise your hand if you saw the business model problem with that. Anyway, after many reports of its demise, MoviePass is officially done as of tomorrow. So if you're a subscriber, I guess you know what you're doing tonight, right? All right, we're going. Dow Industrials up 37 points today, about a 10%. NASDAQ fell 17 points, 0.2%. S&P 500 basically flat on the day. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.